Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, the fact checker and
Kathleen Dunn
on the Ideas of the lifespan of a fact. Jim Fingal, the fact checker of the book, is our guest, and this has been reviewed all over the place the last couple weeks. In case you know nothing about it, in 2003, an essay by John DeGatta was rejected by the magazine that commissioned it due to factual inaccuracies, and that essay eventually became the foundation of his critically acclaimed About a Mountain, which was accepted by another magazine, The Believer. But they handed it first to their own fact checker. There was a call out for a fact checker from the editor. I've got a fun assignment for somebody. We just received a new piece from John DeGatta that needs to be fact checked thoroughly. Apparently, he's taken some liberties, which he's admitted to, but I want to know to what extent. So whoever's up for it will need to comb through this, marking anything and everything that you can confirm is true, as well as whatever you think is questionable. I'll buy you a pack of red pens if necessary. So Jim Fingal did the fact-checking here, and I got to tell you, this went on for a long time. So what the book is a combination of the essay, which concerns a suicide in Las Vegas, along with Fingal's correspondence. And it is thorough and very extensive. So it looks at this whole issue of truth and accuracy and whether it's appropriate for a writer to substitute one for the other. Jim Fingal is our guest this hour of the program. He worked for several years as a fact checker at The Believer and McSweeney's, where he worked on the titles What is the What?, Surviving Justice, Voices from the Storm, and others. He is now designing software and lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, no problem.
You are one thorough guy, aren't you?
The job of a fact checker demands thoroughness. It's a sort of all or nothing task.
Right. Yes, you took it seriously. So the editor wrote this memo, which I just read, a fun assignment for somebody, and you thought this would be a fun assignment. Were you familiar with John's work?
I wasn't up until that point. The reading his reading the essay that was given to me was my sort of first introduction. I think once I was given a little bit of background on who he was and read the piece, I did my own sort of investigation of pieces that he had written before and articles and in introduction to anthologies that he'd written to get a little bit more background on where he was coming from, but I wasn't given that to prepare me before this came across my desk.
And tell me what the essay is all about. You, more than anybody, really knows what the essay is all about. It's more like a short book, isn't it?
Yeah, it's meant to be a lyrical, sort of discursive essay centering around the suicide of a boy, Levi Presley, who kills himself by jumping off the top of the tower at the Stratosphere Casino in Las Vegas. And so from there, it uses that as a sort of starting point to explore suicide in general and suicide specifically in Las Vegas, politics, the media in Las Vegas, and what someone coming in from the outside can actually learn about someone like Levi, who is not sort of like a normal person who does something that you don't necessarily understand. Like, what are the limits of what you can recreate about that?
And John went to Las Vegas to attempt to learn all that he could about this, and his mother lived in Las Vegas, right?
He did. I believe he was in Las Vegas volunteering for the suicide hotline at the time when he received a call that he thought was he later thought was from Levi, who he saw on the news, and that was the sort of impetus for him to start thinking about this and start exploring and doing research.
Mm-hmm. And when you were given the assignment, you took this very, very seriously. I mean, we have a whole book that's devoted to your fact-checking about this. You initially started asking questions of your editor, and I don't know if your editor thought you were asking too many questions or what, but eventually you were told to just take this on yourself and not double-check everything with the editor.
Yeah, well, and the to give a bit of a caveat, some of the, I guess, back and forth between me and the editor and John and I in the book is sort of punched up and synthesized after the fact. But the engagement with the editor was a pretty pretty hands-off sort of thing, where my main contact was the managing editor at the Believer, where the projects that we were given were basically, you know, take this and run with it, and come back in a month or in this case 6 months or a year and give me what you got when you're done.
One of the early responses that you had from John is that he was trying to write something that's interesting to read. How much did you have to take that into consideration as you were checking on all of this? Because it was about a very, very serious subject, the suicide of a very, very young person, and so we're encompassing a lot of different very serious issues here. How much did you have to give him? I'm trying to create something that's interesting to read, so if I'm a little bit loose with the facts, it's okay, because it's a compelling story about an issue that it's important to know about.
Well, from the perspective of the fact checker, it's in a lot of ways irrelevant what the intentions of the author are. One can fact check things that range from, you know, journalistic articles to fiction to, you know, the New Yorker fact checks their cartoons. It's a discipline that you know, applies a certain standard of verifiability and finding evidence for claims or, you know, quotations, facts and figures that are in a text. Sort of independent of the intention, and also independent of, you know, what is going to be done with the fact checking. For this piece, I think the thing that influenced my methodology the most was the idea that this was presented to me as an essay that was a little bit, you know, fast and loose with the facts, and you know, one thing that was told to me that was, you know, we're basically that we wanted to get all of the facts down so that, you know, we could have them on record, and the magazine could have full knowledge of it. But, you know, in all likelihood, a lot of the things wouldn't be corrected, and we would maybe make note of them, or, you know, if there was a manageable number of them, maybe we'd put them in the front matter of the book. And later that turned into, well, maybe we'll have, you know, an online feature that lists all the fact-checking text. But either way, you know, I was doing research and background work for something that probably wasn't really going to have that much of an impact on the final text. So I think that had the greatest influence on my methodology.
When you were thinking about journalistic rules, you at one point talk about to John about the violation of about 10 different rules of journalistic integrity, and he responds, "This is an essay, so journalistic rules don't belong here." What were those rules that you were concerned about?
I think I didn't have particular particular rules in mind. I guess it was more of a, you know, figure of speech, but, you know, in general, just the, you know, the idea that one validates their sources, that they try their best to document conversations or provide evidence for things that they are presenting, and that, you know, when they represent a story or a given narrative, that there's a certain fidelity to factuality beyond just you know, telling a good story.
And what about essays? Do essays play by different rules?
Well, so I guess that I mean, that's an interesting question that we try to explore in the book, is what you know, how does the essay genre differ from journalism? I guess John would argue that it differs greatly, that it has a very different historical background, that its you know, provenance goes back to Herodotus and Cicero and many other authors that you know, similarly were out to tell the truth about something, but weren't that interested in always in the exact fidelity to the facts. And so I think John would say that that's what the essay is, but from, you know, the perspective of the fact checker, and I think what the Jim in the book argues for is trying to understand, well, how does that definition of the genre, how is that similar, or how does that come into conflict with what, I guess, the general public would expect, or, you know, a literary audience or whoever would be reading the magazine would expect, because the, you know, the John's definition of the essay is if everyone agreed with that, then there wouldn't be a controversy about it.
Mm-hmm. Are most fact checkers as thorough as you are? Some have accused you of being nitpicky about all of this. You really are thorough. You were checking every single fact in this. Do most fact checkers do the same thing?
Well, I would say with a few exceptions, I think there are some areas where I'm certainly nitpicky with things like the disputing the color of the bricks outside of the stratosphere, or whether or not the mountains look brown versus black to me. But otherwise, I would say that professional fact checkers are probably much more thorough than I was. The one thing that I did in the fact checking that I think would not be cool in a professional sense would be to rely on a lot of online resources or secondary resources, or you know, just confirming that something had been said by someone rather than verifying the reliability of the source. So in a lot of ways, it's a little bit of an amateur fact-checking job, despite the thoroughness.
Mm-hmm. What about the quotes that were used here, the interviews that he did? Did he take notes on this, and did you have ethical concerns that he was not quoting people accurately, which would bother the heck out of me, I think?
Yeah, well, I was, at the beginning of the project, I was given two gigantic, you know, FedEx boxes full of semi-organized clippings and notes, and you know, a packet from the suicide hotline, various other background. I think there were occasionally snippets of quotes, but I mean, as John says in the book, he doesn't really actively take notes or record conversations during interviews, because, you know, part of he wants to put people at ease, and it's not as important to him to get the exact quotations down. So, I mean, it was a little bit strange in that I was checking the checking the quotes in the essay against notes that had been, you know, jotted down after the fact, which themselves could have been changed or synthesized.
And the reason for not, did he feel that he got more from people? But he could have been quoting them. If you're not quoting somebody accurately, then you're interpreting what they're saying. I mean, you're having them say something that you want to have them say because it's more captivating, or it goes with the flow of a story, or it's more poetic, or whatever. Did he feel that he got more from them because he didn't have a tape recorder or didn't have notes, and thus it made it more lyrical, or what?
Yeah, well, I think it's two things. I mean, it's exactly as you described, the sort of interpretation and getting the, I guess, the spirit of what they're saying, and in rewriting that or interpreting that through his artistic vision is one thing, and another is just the desire to have those interviews be more of a conversation rather than a performance, which I think John has said that, you know, whenever he's had a tape recorder or taken notes, then people sort of take on a different persona, and they start you know, phrasing things differently, or speaking from you know, almost acting like characters rather than people who are just having a conversation.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We'll do that in a moment. Maybe some of you have had a chance to read the book already or have read the essay. You've certainly read things about this because it's been reviewed all over the place. The Lifespan of a Fact is the book that we're talking about this hour. The fact checker and co-author, Jim Fingal, is our guest. And the book essentially is, in black, the essay that was written about this suicide in Las Vegas, and then in red, the dialogue that took place over a long period of time between the fact-checker Jim and the author John DeGatta. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The other questions, are there different journalistic rules if you are an essayist? Can you take some liberty with the facts to get a better flow in your story, to make your poetry or your words more poetic? Can you take liberty with quoting people? Do you need to be very, very accurate about the color of the trucks and the color of the building and the number of seconds that it took for someone to fall to his death? All of that was investigated by our guest. And then, of course, we have to get to why they decide to do a book about this. What about the ethics in the field of journalism in terms of giving us the truth? Or can you take some liberties with that for art? We welcome your calls at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we're going to celebrate St. Patrick's Day just a little bit early because I'll be off on St. Patrick's Day, which is Saturday, and so Frank Delaney will join us. It's become somewhat of a tradition, a very erudite Irishman who writes novels and essays about Ireland, and he will join us, and we'll hear a little bit of music and maybe read some poems, so it'll be good. First hour of our show, Alabama and Mississippi having primaries today. We will have guests analyzing the results and a couple major voting rights, voting ID, actually, decisions here in Wisconsin and also in Texas. So we will be speaking with the director of the ACLU Voting Rights Project, who's going to be the keynote speaker at their banquet coming up this Saturday in Milwaukee. So we'll squeeze that into tomorrow's conversation. And before we start taking phone calls, we're talking about the lifespan of a fact. Was there any question about whether or not, Jim, this essay was going to be published if you found that there were too many errors in this?
Well, I think that, the genesis of it coming to the Believer was John, the essay had been commissioned by Harper's, and then eventually killed by them. And then Heidi Julevitz, one of the editors of The Believer, I think heard John read from it at a reading and was interested in it. And, you know, he disclosed the the reason why the essay was killed, and described his sort of methodology and the believer being more of a sort of independent artistic cultural review, intended on publishing it with that knowledge as a an exploration of what the essay could be. So at no point when I was checking it did it seem to ever be in question that, if I found 200 rather than 150 things wrong with it, that it would, cross the line.
But did your editor expect you to convince him to change this, the inaccuracies?
I'm not really sure. I mean, I felt like my job was to sort of provide a nonpartisan report that offered up the facts for either the author to choose to make corrections, or for the editor, if it seemed like something that needed to be changed, if it was potentially libelous or whatnot, that it was sort of up to them to do it. But of course, the spirit of neutrality of the fact checker, and also the reality of spending a lot of time on the project, can sometimes come into conflict.
Let's take a call from Bob from Bailey's Harbor. Hi, Bob. Hi, Bob. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen. Wonderful topic. I wondered, you're talking about what is a fact of fact and Stephen Colbert's truthiness, if it wouldn't be a good opportunity to ask your guest what he thinks of Wikipedia.
Okay.
Yeah, well, so this is interesting. I was actually at a conference this week called Truthiness in Digital Media that was put on by the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. The Wikipedia is an interesting thing because it sort of illustrates the it's something that we know is not the same level of accuracy as the Encyclopedia Britannica. Like it's not researched by experts or vetted with the same sources 100% of the time, but at the same time, most people are willing to accept that, and sort of they understand when they read something from Wikipedia that it's not necessarily the gospel truth, that it's open to revision, or there can be inaccuracies, but the ease of getting that information and the breadth of the information is sort of good enough for them, and that's sort of, I mean, there's an interesting parallel in that to the fact checking that's done for the New York Times versus for the Believer versus the New Yorker. It's the level that one verifies facts or assertions sort of differs depending on who it's for, or what level of either skepticism or trust the reader or the user or whoever is engaging with the information expects to have, and then also just the level of I guess how much weight the organization in general or the publication in general puts towards those things. I think Wikipedia is an interesting example and one that touches a lot of people every day of just this, our willingness to accept the instability and unreliability of facts for sort of expediency.
Yeah. I learned my lesson by using Wikipedia years ago for background information on a guest, just assuming that they would have information correct about where the person had worked and et cetera. And he corrected me on the air and he said, where did you get that information? And I don't know if I said Wikipedia or not, but it really taught me that I have to read those in an entirely different fashion, maybe for an overview of an issue, but not for specifics.
Yeah. I mean, I think for a journalist, I think Wikipedia, well, for a journalist and for a fact checker, Wikipedia is a sort of like a no-go zone. But at the same time, it's a very useful jumping-off point for learning more. And often there will be references, or it will give you, a lot of the ways that we find information on the internet today is through searching, and in order to search for something, you often need to know what you're looking for. And Wikipedia giving you, some accurate information, some inaccurate information, hopefully mostly accurate information, but at least it sort of points you in the right direction if you want to then go to primary sources or more vetted sources.
Mm-hmm. Reed in Sister Bay, hi. Hi, Reed, are you there? No, call us back, Reed. Why is it that the two of you went back and forth on this for years and years? Why did it take so long?
Well, so, I mean, the big reveal of the book is that a lot of the back and forth that happened between John and I was actually after the main initial fact-checking job at The Believer was done. The initial fact-checking took about, the bulk of it, 6 months, and then continued on for over the course of the rest of the year as revisions were made and follow-up fact-checking was done. After that time, we sort of looked at the document that that was produced out of it, which was this 100-page document breaking the essay down into individual sentences, and every assertion and factual thing that could be checked bolded and called out. And I think as John has described, his first that was given to both the editor and to John, to give him the option to change things, and he says his response was first anger and then embarrassment and then thought it was interesting in that the sort of the obsessiveness of that fact checking task sort of paralleled what he saw the obsessiveness of the research that he does. And the attempt to get at the factual truth, parallels his attempt to get at the spiritual or artistic truth about things.
Mm-hmm.
So then at that point, we talked about it and thought it would be an interesting idea to do a book project out of it. And from that point, I think the years that we spent on it was, or were us going back and forth, expanding the fact checking. The initial interaction between John and I during the fact checking process was, relatively professional and some might say boring. So. Part of what we did in putting the book together was dramatizing that conflict a bit, and through in some ways creating these parallel characters of John and Jim, we were sort of able to have it out with each other in ways that we couldn't in the original fact-checking engagement, and it allowed us to have that ongoing debate that sort of took so long and got to the heart of both the what John considers to be his primary art form and my concerns with that.
Mm-hmm. Reed from Sister Bay. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead, Reed.
I'm halfway through the book. It's a great read, and it'd be great if it was required reading for any school of journalism. I think the problem I saw with John's essay is that it's seemingly factual, and yet his argument is over and over again that essays are fundamentally philosophical, which, you know, I agree with him. Cicero, Montaigne, or Montaigne, their essays are philosophical, but they're explicitly philosophical. They come out and say right in the title, you know, an essay on virtue, an essay on reason, and whereas John's essay was, on the face of it, it seemed very factual. And so he kind of would seem like he was trying to have his cake and eat it too. And that's my comment.
I think that's a good point. There are things that are, these things happen on this day. There were other deaths. There were so many cancer deaths, etc. You look at it and you say, well, this is meant to be a completely factual part of this essay. But you had problems with some of the facts that were put in that, what happened on this day. That's problematic, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I guess that, I mean, that boils down to the question that, you know, in a lot of ways the book, both within the book and the book itself, asks is, you know, what sort of writing needs a disclaimer on it, and what are the expectations of the audience?
Mm.
I mean, since John isn't here, I think I can argue both points. So I think he would say you know, part of what he means to do in you know, this particular piece is to do a sort of, you know, experimental mashup between the journalistic mode and a sort of different, more literary mode, and, you know, part of the effect of the book relies on initially reading it as journalism, and then, you know, not to give too many spoilers away, if you're halfway through the book, but you know, then later signaling that mode is maybe insufficient to explore or to illustrate the sorts of things that it means to get at, and so, you know, giving a disclaimer beforehand would sort of not allow him to sort of craft that the effect on the reader to be in one mode and then to sort of be shaken up and realize that in fact what they were reading was something different.
Mm-hmm. Melody,
I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, that
yes.
the you know, if what he were writing was something that was published in the New York Times, I don't think many people would accept that. But if what he's writing is meant to be a literary essay, you know, that's going to be in an anthology of creative nonfiction, I mean, what do we require of writing like that? That's different from journalism.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Melody, Washington Island. Hi, Melody.
Hi. This, my question may have just been answered. I heard him in the discussion on Wikipedia contrast the New York Times with the New Yorker or Atlantic Monthly, I can't remember which it was, and I was wondering what his definition was for contrasting those two types of media. But also, I was a reporter from 20 to 30 years ago, and I've watched with absolute disbelief the lack of necessity for double-checking the quote-unquote facts that are reported these days. So I'd be interested in getting his take on that as well.
Yeah, well, so it's, I guess, strict journalism versus, like, magazine publishing in some ways is different, you know, as I understand it. Because it seems, you know, there's writing for a newspaper. There's the writers are expected to have a sort of journalistic code and to check their sources and to sort of provide baseline material that is vetted in a certain way. And, you know, I've never worked at a newspaper, so I can't tell you exactly how that works or, you know, to what degree things are fact-checked from sort of independent agents within a newspaper. But, you know, a magazine seems a little bit different because it's, you know, tends to collect content from a variety of different sources, often not staff writers, so that more relies on sort of in-house fact-checking. It's an interesting thing because it seems, I mean, another thing that differs is the sort of time scale for a news article versus a magazine article, whereas it seems as if with the incredible increase in pace that people expect to get news, particularly with social media and you know, hearing things first on Twitter or Facebook, it seems like there's a parallel pressure for news organizations to sort of break stories first and report instantaneously, which you know, there's a definite trade-off between speed and accuracy, and I think that's maybe part of what has led to the recent rise in these things like PolitiFact or FactCheck.org, like external organizations that are sort of dedicated to provide the role that they see that media is not, you know, providing in policing either journalism or you know, political speeches or whatnot.
Has there been an increase in the number of magazines, newspapers, nonfiction publishers with a charge of libel?
You know, I don't know the answer to that.
So, I just wonder about that because, well, has there been a huge increase? You mentioned PolitiFact and some of those. Are there more places that publish nonfiction or do the news that are hiring people like what you used to do fact checking?
I think that the problem is that they're with the decline in revenue for a lot of newspapers and media organizations, that role is actually declining within the organization, and there are, you know, less people to fact check, and that's you know, part of what has led to I think that's part of what's led to the, you know, groups of people outside of the media feeling the need to sort of step in and play that policing role, because you know, for sort of structural reasons, it's becoming harder for those publications to produce things at both the same rate and the same factual quality as in previous years.
How do you fact check a cartoon at the New Yorker?
Well, I think one example is that I remember seeing is just, you know, if there's a cartoon and the characters are, you know, on the front steps of the Supreme Court, you make sure that the number of columns in the building are the same number as are illustrated. You know, make sure that if some sort of you know, historical or current event is cited, that that it's, you know, spelled correctly or referenced correctly. Or, you know, if there's some sort of geographical reference. I remember one describing there was some sort of involving crossing a highway and it was rejected because the highway didn't actually run or divide two cities in the way that it appeared in the cartoon.
Interesting. We welcome more phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. Jim Fingle is our guest, co-author, really, of The Lifespan of a Fact, which has recently been released and receiving a lot of attention. It's a correspondence, years-long correspondence between John DeGatta and Jim Fingal, who was an intern, actually, at The Believer, assigned to check John's essay, which was on a suicide in Las Vegas, suicide committed by a 17 or 16-year-old boy. And so it looks at the fact-checking and the response to the fact-checking, and it's interesting. It's meant to be the essay, nonfiction, and tell the story of a real person, but the essayist has said that, of course, he took liberties because there are different journalistic rules that apply to essayists. So what about the truth? That's what we're talking about this hour of the show with the fact checker, who's no longer a fact checker, but he was. So join us if you'd like. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this hour, we celebrate St. Patrick's Day a little bit early, but those of you who are celebrating are probably involved in celebrations all this week. Frank Delaney will join us. Frank has written a series of books, novels about Ireland, and he's written nonfiction as well. He's a historian, and he's a great, great writer and grand fellow. I think you'll enjoy our traditional conversation with Frank Delaney tomorrow at 10. At 9 o'clock tomorrow, we'll be looking at the primary votes in Alabama and Mississippi for the Republican presidential race. And we will also be looking at the voter ID decisions, the decision in Texas and the decision in Wisconsin. Our guest will be the director of the Voting Rights Project for the ACLU. So all of that is coming up tomorrow on our show. Don in Eau Claire is our next caller. Hi, Don.
Hi. I was in a seminar in Madison about 60 years ago at the UW in economics. Professor Edwin Witte, who was, in a sense, the father of the Social Security Act and head of the War Labor Board during the Second World War, I still remember a quote, and he was saying, basically, this gentleman was saying, if the facts are with you, you cite the facts. If the law is with you, you cite the law. If neither the facts nor the law are with you, you pound the table. I think of that every time I think of some of these political things that are going on these days. The quotes, had a fundraising letter recently, I had many of them, and saying basically, well, in Wisconsin, we are making progress. The unemployment rate has dropped considerably, and therefore we just let's keep going. Let's continue as before. Well, why is the unemployment rate dropping? I called the writer in the newspaper, Eau Claire Leader Telegram, and asked, the unemployment rate is dropping. Has it been dropping nationally at the same time? And he said, yeah, in other words, the facts that were quoted to try and get me to send money to support, in this case, to oppose the recall, were just facts that were not really very accurate. What caused what? Why does the unemployment rate drop? Would it have dropped anyway? And then, of course, you hear the many people saying, well, look, can governors or presidents really maneuver things in such a way that the unemployment rate will be affected? And they just do not have as much control as implied in some of the advertising. And facts that are so-called facts that are quoted may be factual, but what caused what? I've been upset sometimes about the accuracy or the use of so-called facts.
Hmm. Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I think Susan Sontag has a book about photographs, and in it she, one of the points she makes is that a photograph is not an argument. And I think in a lot of ways, a fact itself is not an argument, even if a fact is describe something true in the world, you know, what is that evidence for? You know, what analysis do you do based on that is, almost a totally separate question. I think the realms of politics is, you know, a lot of ways a, not to say anything bad about our book, but in some ways a lot higher stakes realm for the question of facticity. The question of how facts are used and how they're cited, and you know where does fact become evidence and where does evidence become a good analysis is a big question in politics, and I think one that disturbingly is a sort of free for all in mm-hmm. amongst both political parties.
Thank you very much for your great call, Don. Pam is next in Galena. Hi, Pam.
Good morning. Great show. Thank you so much. I'm calling because I'm an independent contractor. I work for educational publishers, and I just wanted to comment on how important fact checkers are, even though at times they have annoyed the heck out of me. But they just make a it's tremendously comforting as a writer to know that someone is checking your facts. So thank you, Jim, for your previous work, and I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, to make a nerdy reference, it seems like fact checkers are the sort of the QA team of the journalistic world in terms of the software world. It's meant to be the sort of the catch-all to not only play an antagonistic role to catch those sneaky authors who are trying to sneak things in, but to catch unintentional things that are mistakes or might have been taken from one source, but another source conflicts with it. So the role of the fact checker is meant to be, both for the publication and the publication's reputation and for the reader, but also, for the author. In some cases, when I worked on What is the What, a book that is sort of marketed as fiction, but is in a lot of ways more like oral history or creative nonfiction. I was commissioned by Dave Eggers, the author, to fact check it. In that case, it was entirely the work was being done for the author, so that the author could know that any deviations from the historical record that they made were choices that they make. It's not such an evil antagonistic job.
Thanks, Pam. Rose in Blanchard. Hi, Rose.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, you?
I'm fine.
Good.
I was just reading an article not too long ago written by Moynihan, and one of the things that really struck out to me was when he put in there in quotes that someone else had said this, and I think this is this is probably why people have bad language, because they don't know when to put things in quotes. But everyone is entitled to their own opinion, but not to their own truth. And I that really struck with me, because I look at this as something that you could use in your life. I think when the church says you have to do this or you have to do that, I say to myself, is that God's law or is that church law? Mm. And that's how I make my decisions. So I don't know how you think about that, but I don't know. That struck me.
Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the quibbler in me that for that sort of thing is like, what do you mean by truth? is truth a synonym for belief, or is it is truth something that's separate from facts in the sense that facts are evidence and truth is the hidden or public analysis of how things really work and how those facts of the world connect together. So I think that's a question that is much debated. Both how do we define truth and what are what's the tolerance level in which people can have I guess disagree and both be right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Jim, for being with us. Fascinating book, and I enjoyed the conversation. Jim Fingal, he's the co-author of The Lifespan of a Fact. John DeGatta is the other co-author, and it was his essay that Jim was doing the fact-checking on. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network, so please stay with us. News will be on the air momentarily. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.